Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Right, so Monday morning, lots to talk about coming out of yesterday, such as the return of Drew Brees, and wait for it, just as importantly, the return of Matt Schaub. Now, when the Saints announced that Drew Brees was going to play yesterday against Arizona, it did seem a little bit weird to me. Not as weird as it seemed to Trevor Price, who thought that he was not going to play again this year, but a little weird to me. A little weird in the sense that the Saints had gone undefeated without Drew Brees, and they had just one more game until their bye. So why not just wait? Why not get the extra week? Why rush back? What if your Hall of Famer is not ready? Come to find out, Drew Brees was ready. He was 373 yards and three touchdowns ready. That could not have gone any better for the Saints than it did. You lose your Hall of Fame quarterback in week two. You wonder about your entire season, but then you run off five straight. You bring him back to win a sixth, and now you head into a bye. You know who else was ready yesterday? Joe Flacco. Joe freaking Flacco was ready to bleep some stuff up and take some chances late in the game with a 13-12 lead over Indy. But apparently, the Broncos coaches would not let him, because instead of letting the legend spin it late and pull off the shocker over the Colts, they called for a run on 3rd and 5 late in the game. Philip Lindsay gets stuffed, the Colts get the ball back, and they stab Flacco and Bronco Nation right in the heart with a late game-winning field goal. And if you thought that Joe Flacco was going to roll with that, then you really don't know Joe Flacco, because Joe Flacco was pissed, and Joe Flacco did not try to hide it.
We're now a 2-6 football team, and we're like afraid to go for it in a 2-minute drill. You know, like, who cares if you give the ball back to the guys with 1:40 left? They obviously got the field goal anyway. And once again, we're a 2-6 football team, and it just feels like we're kind of afraid to lose a game. It's 3rd and 5 at the end of the game. You know, it's who cares if they have a timeout there at the end or not? You know, getting in field goal range isn't that tough. You know, so you're just putting your defense in these bad situations, and I just felt like, what do we have to lose? Like, why can't we be aggressive in some of these situations? That's kind of how I feel about a lot of the game today.
Are you going to tell me that guy's not elite? Oh, man, that was elite. That was elite. That was awesome. I mean, that was beautiful. When is the last time you saw a quarterback take a run at his coaches like that? When was the last time you saw a quarterback crack everybody for being afraid and for being cowards? That is the best thing that that legend has said since he talked about running onto the field to take out an opponent during the Super Bowl.
If he starts to break it, go tackle him.
Really?
I don't know. I mean, what else? What can they? I don't know. I mean, they might be able to give him a touchdown on that, but I don't know. Hey, if he breaks it, if he busts this for some reason, tackle him. Go tackle him. I don't know what the rule is on that, but I will. I'm going to.
I don't know what I like better. His teammates saying, really? Or Flacco trying to get his attention with that now infamous, hey!
If he starts to break...
Hey, let me ask you something.
Let me ask you something, Alvy. Hey! What are you doing? Only slightly better. And that was elite as well. And only slightly better than that one time when out of nowhere, even though this show has no relationship with the man at all, he called into the show just to shoot the breeze with me and talk a little ball.
Good to have you on the show, Joe. What's up?
Hey, Jim. How you doing today?
Good, good. How about you?
Yeah, this is Joe Flacco. I heard Martellus canceled, so I thought I'd give you a call.
Dude, that's absolutely incredible. Joe Flacco. You know, not to be insulting, what jersey number do you wear?
Joe Flacco, number 5.
Okay. What college did you go to?
Delaware, Blue Hens.
Okay. What is your wife's name?
Deborah.
Deborah?
Well, I call her Debbie, but...
Okay, well, really, because the rest of us call her Dana, but whatever. She is your wife. How many sons do you have?
I've got 2 boys.
What are their names?
Joe Jr. and Joe III.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Hey!
Not a very good call.
Among my all-time favorite Joe Flacco moments, the time he called this show out of the blue. All right, but let's go back to what he said yesterday. because the fact is he's right. He is exactly right in what he said. Why not take a chance? You're a 2-6 football team. What the hell do you have to lose? Well, besides another game. You don't have to be Joe Flacco to know that playing not to lose is going to get you beat just about every single time. This guy's absolutely right. You're 2-6. Try to close out the game aggressively, and maybe you move to 3-5. Not a huge improvement, but at least you would not have your quarterback ripping into the coaches after the game. Like Flacco, he may have never actually been an elite quarterback, but that was an elite take because of what he said and what he said it. In fact, I'm not sure he's ever been more elite than he was in that moment yesterday. And going back to who I started with, my man Matt Schaub. Matt Schaub threw for 460 yards as a Falcon against the Seahawks in 2019. That is utterly amazing because he was playing as a Falcon against the Seahawks during the 04 season. That's how incredible that is, what he did yesterday. That he went off for 460 yards against the Seahawks yesterday when, as a member of the same Falcon team, he went up against them in 04. Absolutely incredible. But not as incredible as your iPhone auto-correcting Schaub to Schlub. Now that's amazing. Amazing in and of itself. Try it. Amazing. I'll tell you why it's amazing. It's amazing that it's the first time in history that autocorrect got something right. Try that yourself. Put that in your iPhone right now. You know what that'd be like? That'd be like Siri jumping in and saying, I see you wrote Matt Schaub. Do you mean Matt Schlub? I mean, this guy went up against that same team in 04. That was so long ago that Falcons head coach Jim Mora was sending him out there as the team rested Michael Vick before their playoff game. That was so long ago that he was handing off to Warrick Dunn and throwing to Peerless Price. And yesterday he was back at it again. But Matt Schaub was not the problem. The Falcons defense once again was the problem. You see, that problem is not changing. Not only have the Falcons not lived up to expectations, they are completely imploding. In fact, I'd be hard pressed to think of a more disappointing team in recent years than the Falcons. 1-7? 1-7 with that talent. A defense that porous with a defensive specialist as head coach. Oh, and by the way, 12th bag? I don't expect you to give it back. And yes, it is very hard to win in the NFL, regardless. But especially when your defense is allowing old man Matt Schaub to come off the bench and light you on fire. How many of you even knew this guy was still alive, much less still playing in the NFL? And yet he's torching the Seahawks. Not exactly Legion of Boom material, is it? I mean, if that guy can do you like that, what's going to happen in the event that you play yourself into the postseason and have to play an actual NFL quarterback? Matt Schaub lit the Seahawks up for 460. Yeah, they won. Do that. Put in your iPhone. Tell me what happens. That's the first time autocorrect ever got something right. And now that we're talking about expectations, why don't we take a moment and talk about the San Francisco 49ers. What were your expectations for the 49ers this year? Before the season, what were you thinking about this team and what they might do? Hell, what were you thinking about them going into yesterday? Because I know what Gerald McCoy and the Panthers were thinking going into yesterday. Roll it. Ooh.
Hey, hey, it's time. It's time.
Let's go.
We about to see what all that is about. Woo. All that talking, all they this, all they that. They done played a lot of people, but they ain't played us.
Yeah.
We about to see what it's all about because we went all the smoke.
Sure.
We went all the smoke.
We want all the smoke. We want all the smoke. Yeah, well, a few hours later, San Francisco 51, Carolina 13, half a hundred. Is that enough smoke? Be careful what you wish for, because the Panthers damn near died of smoke inhalation. But even after Tevin Coleman had four touchdowns, and the Niners offense put up 51 on the Panthers, and Nick Bosa had 3 sacks and an INT. Improve visibility and save money at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Stop by for their See Better Drive Safer sale where you can earn a $15 gift card after a mail-in rebate when you purchase either Sylvania headlight bulbs or Bosch Focus or Treco Titan wiper blades. They'll even install your wiper blades for free while you wait. Don't risk your safety because of poor visibility. Let the professional parts people at O'Reilly help you find just what you need. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. Charles Robinson is my guest. Charles, what's up? How are you?
What's up, brother? How are you doing today?
Good, man. Good, good. Good to have you back. Listen, you and I have talked a number of times over the years. You've been around the game a long time. Let me start right here. Where does that Aaron Rodgers pass in the fourth quarter against Kansas City last night rank for you?
It depends on if he was trying to do that. Like I when I initially saw it, you know, I was like everyone else. I'm like, that's the most unbelievable pass. I mean, other than maybe, you know, Russell Wilson hitting Tyler Lockett in the left pocket of the end zone earlier this season. You cannot increase the degree of difficulty, and Rodgers is getting hit on that. And then when I saw the replay, I mean, it definitely looked like he was aiming the ball there. Like, it looked like a pass that he was trying to throw. It's just, I think what makes it so astronomically unbelievable is that even when you watch it in slow motion, you're like, I'm still not sure that it's too perfect a pass for him to throw, even for a guy like Aaron Rodgers. I just don't know how you can increase the degree of difficulty and actually mean to have been throwing it where Aaron Rodgers threw it. Like, if you don't get better than that. There's no way to improve upon that pass.
So was that the plan, or was he trying to throw it away?
I think he was throwing it into a direction and going, I hope my guy catches it. Like, I have a really hard time believing he thought, this is right where my guy is going to be. I'm going to throw it on a dime. But I'll say this. This is why when we go out to practices and we watch these guys throw into, you know, trash cans that are 20, 30 yards down the field, and you think, how is that ever going to be applicable in a game? That felt like a trash can throw to me. That's like, okay, that's why I watch these guys literally put balls into trash cans, you know, with a high arc 20 or 30 yards away. That's exactly the type of throw that was.
We're talking to Charles Robinson. All right, so one more thought about the Packers. I think a lot of credit goes to Kansas City for the way they showed up last night with all the injuries, but it's 7-1. How good are the Packers?
I think they're, to me, look, that's the force to be reckoned with in the NFC right now. I think the Packers, Matt LaFleur has gotten everything out of Aaron Rodgers that I think Mike McCarthy couldn't at the end last year. You know, I think Rodgers is having fun playing the game. He feels challenged. He feels like he can challenge Matt LaFleur, you know, to be maybe some of the things that Mike McCarthy wasn't. If he feels like they're not being creative enough, if he feels like there are certain times at the line of scrimmage where, you know, he wants to be able to switch into, you know, things that make, maybe he knew he'd get an earful from Mike McCarthy later about it. He feels like he has the control that he wants. Now he's got a running game behind him. And then, you know, defensively, this is probably the one team that I think quietly upgraded more than any other team in the offseason. You know, they shed some guys. I think they kind of felt like the grade on Clay Matthews was getting to the point where they needed to move on from him. There were just a number of guys that I think they needed to shuffle out. They revamped with some of the better free agent signings of the offseason. I don't know. I mean, it's, to me, the NFC is wide open, but I look at how the Packers are playing right now, the teams that they're beating, and the way Aaron Rodgers clearly feels about himself right now, and he's healthy, and I just don't know how there's any other team in the NFC you say that is clearly the number one over this one.
Charles Robinson, yes. He is a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo Sports. All right, so the Chicago Bears, let me move on, keep it in the division, though. They spent their entire offseason essentially blaming their postseason loss on their kicker. They seem to be absolutely fixated on that kicking issue all offseason, and then yesterday happens. Is it safe to say that their kicking issue has not been resolved and that kicking is not their only issue?
Well, Matt Nagy coming out and really backing Eddie Pinheiro as much as he possibly could. I think he knows it's because I have no options right now, but there's no doubt that the kicking issue isn't fixed, but that's not even their biggest issue. Like, we can get into, you know, you miss field goals to lose games and that's devastating, but they made a decision at quarterback now that's not going away. You know, you pass on Deshaun Watson, you pass on Patrick Mahomes, and you take a Mitch Trubisky who now looks like they've tried to make him into a pocket quarterback and it is just not working. And the offensive line, particularly with Kyle Long out for the season, is nowhere where it needs to be for him to be a pocket quarterback. I think that's the alarming long-term issue there. That's the alarming issue for Matt Nagy's job security. Ryan Pace, the general manager there, there's a decision that was made on the quarterback now that's going to have lasting effects. And then you have these two guys in Deshaun Watson and Pat Mahomes who are constantly going to be linked to him every year moving forward. So we can get into the kicker, but look, this year and beyond, the next 2-3 years, and the destiny of both that coaching staff and that front office, I think is all on fixing Mitch Trubisky, and I don't know how many people in the league really think his game is fixable.
We are talking to Charles Robinson. All right, let me move on. Gerald McCoy, the Panthers, was getting his teammates fired up before that game against the 49ers and said repeatedly, we want all the smoke. We want all the smoke. And that's exactly what they got, right? All the smoke. San Francisco drops 51 on their heads. How impressed were you with the way the 49ers took apart a Panthers team that was playing pretty well coming in?
I mean, the 49ers up front defensively, it's remarkable that this is what John Lynch and Kyle Shanahan, I spent some time with them in June, and they were like, look, our front seven defensively is going to be off the charts. So, like, as long as everybody's healthy, we think that we can dominate games with the front seven of our defense. And that is exactly what's happening. Like, Nick Bosa, talk about a guy who, I mean, I can't believe there were any down draft assessments on him. And if there were, you probably need to fire that scout like immediately, because this guy is not only a defensive rookie of the year candidate, he's a defensive player of the year candidate. He dominated that game up front. There was nothing the Panthers could do, you know, with him. And yeah, I think if you're running the football, Jimmy Garoppolo, you know, I still think with Kyle Shanahan, you don't want to get into games where Jimmy's throwing it 40 plus times. So to me, this is exactly the kind of game they want to play. Dominate teams defensively, show that you can run the ball, be efficient throwing it. The 49ers are 100% a handful. Like that to me, the Niners and the Green Bay Packers are the two where it's easy to look at them and say that's the class of the NFC right now, particularly with the Seattle Seahawks losing their starting center for the season.
Charles Robinson joining us. All right, let me ask you about the Browns. They're coming off another tough showing, this time losing to New England. Now, again, I've got to own this. I was not just on board with that bandwagon. I built that thing last year. I was driving it. I'm not still getting off just yet. But that said, what's your reaction when you hear Baker Mayfield say their issue seems to be, quote, consistency, discipline, and a lack of accountability, end quote?
It's like the holy trinity of the right? death spiral in your season. It's just, you could not have picked three worse words to come out of a starting quarterback's mouth, mostly because you're talking about three things that all lean heavily on the coaching staff. Like, you can say that, particularly lack of accountability. You can say that players have to be accountable, you know, to each other, but lack of accountability is never just a player problem. That's a head coaching problem, and everyone's looking at Freddie Kitchens right now saying, is this guy in over his head? Those three words, when he said that, I had flashbacks to Ben McAdoo with the New York Giants, another coach who essentially got chosen by Eli Manning. That's who he wanted to be the head coach of the Giants, appeared to be in over his head pretty quickly with the Giants. And now you're looking at Freddie Kitchens and you're hearing some of the same things. And lack of accountability was the number one problem with Ben McAdoo. If that's the number one problem with Freddie Kitchens, it's really difficult to fix that quickly. That has a lot to do with the locker room, whether your coach can be a strong enough leader. I don't know where the Browns are going to go with this, but I will say this about your bandwagon. Don't jump off just yet, because the back end of that schedule is very favorable, but it also suggests that if the Browns can't turn this around in the back end against a kind of a cream puff schedule, that means that you probably got to look at Freddie Kitchens and whether or not you made a mistake with that hire.
I'm not off yet. All right, so John Dorsey and the Browns have made no secret of the fact that they're in the market for an offensive tackle ahead of tomorrow's trade deadline. We know Trent Williams is still holding out in Washington. One source told you, quote, Dorsey has been trying to get Williams for basically 6 weeks, but Bruce Allen refuses to trade him. It's all Bruce. He won't do it, end quote. So, Charles, what is the argument for Washington refusing to trade a guy who simply does not want to be there?
There's no logical argument, like, at this point, because Trent Williams has made it known that I don't want to be in that organization, that he does not want to be in the organization with Bruce Allen. He doesn't trust Bruce Allen. I think he doesn't trust ownership. I think there have been so many things breached at this point, but the only thing the Redskins can hope is that either there's a better offer in the offseason, or that, you know, Trent Williams just waves the white flag and says, fine, I'll show up next season. But he won't be happy. And it's emblematic of the things that the Redskins do wrong in their organization. Why are you going to keep a guy who a multitude of teams are offering good assets for to acquire him, and you're just saying, no, we're refusing because we're making a point here. It just doesn't make any sense. And it's frankly, it's driving a number of NFL teams crazy because they're trying to get Trent Williams. It's not like the Cleveland Browns have been the only ones to make the call to try and peel Trent Williams off that roster. And the Washington Redskins just aren't doing it. And it's in spite of logic at this point. And, you know, that's frankly what the problem has been often with Bruce Allen at the helm of that organization.
It's a joke. It's the most Redskin thing ever. I mean, it's absurd. It's just personal, and it makes no sense whatsoever. Patriots are 8-0. They've already made a move for Mohamed Sanu. You've been talking to people around the league. Have you gotten the sense that the Pats are done making deals, or are they still looking for help?
No, they're still making calls. I mean, they're being aggressive right into the deadline. And, you know, I think they would like to upgrade the tackle position, or at least, you know, they're going to get Isaiah Wynn back, but I think they want to add some depth there, maybe some flexibility, because they know, look, you can never have too many quality offensive linemen to lean on in a playoff run. They have 12 draft picks left for next year. A number of those are compensatory picks, but, you know, look, their first, their third round pick, their fourth round pick, these are still assets that they can flip, particularly knowing that they're probably going to be at the end of all of those rounds. You know, I think they're interested in acquiring a tight end. They've basically reached out to every, you know, general manager who's out there in the NFL who's been under the Patriots tree at some point. You know, Bob Quinn with the Detroit Lions, Thomas Dimitroff with the Atlanta Falcons, Jason Light with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and said, hey, you know, are you interested in dealing your tight end? I think, you know, Tyler Eifert with the Cincinnati Bengals, there's going to be a call made there. They're definitely looking to improve some of the pieces around Tom Brady, but I think what the one interesting thing is, I had an executive point out, hey, go back to 2016. They pick up Kyle Van Noy at the trade deadline from the Lions. Kyle Van Noy is going to be an astronomically paid free agent player this offseason. He's like, just because they are a great team defensively, don't rule out Bill Belichick stacking assets on a strength. He doesn't worry about that. He'll just figure, hey, we'll shut teams out in the playoffs.
Charles Robinson, my guest. One last thought. You made the point on Twitter that there could be some cornerbacks looking for a fresh start. Guys like Aqib Talib, Chris Harris Jr., Josh Norman, Janoris Jenkins, all big names. How many of these guys are legitimate difference makers, though, at this point?
It's like the damaged goods clearance aisle at the grocery store at this point with the aging cornerbacks. I mean, like, it's all those guys that you named at some point have been all pro players and yet are really suffering. I mean, look, Chris Harris of the Denver Broncos, top 10 cornerback right now. It will cost you to get him from the Denver Broncos. And I think he would also like to do a contract extension, but he's the guy in that group that's really worth it. I think NFL teams know that. I think Aqib Talib in the right situation, if he knows the system, he won't come off IR. He won't be available until very late in the season. So basically you're going to get him for really a game at the end of the schedule and then a playoff run if you're that kind of a team. I think Talib can still be helpful to a team. But if you're looking at, you know, Janoris Jenkins, if you're looking at a Josh Norman, these are guys that are very scheme specific and they have holes in their game at this stage. I still think that the two guys that are probably worthwhile for a playoff or Super Bowl caliber team are going to be Aqib Talib and Chris Harris.
He is a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo, the co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast, Charles Robinson. My man, such a good hit. Appreciate you very much, Charles. Thank you for doing that.
Always my pleasure, Jim. Take care.
Great content, man. Thank you very much. Clones, what do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? Not bars, not a sugary snack, not even an energy drink. No, we want beef. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is awesome. It is not shriveled. It's not dry. It's not tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. It's tender. It's tasty. It's not tough. And what makes it so good? Because of the company behind it. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for its relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. Old Trapper is packed with protein. It comes in 4 great flavors. Quality smoked meat at its finest that goes wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach, anywhere. So look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, Clones, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? But I want to talk about last night's game, too. Kansas City, when they finally ruled out Patrick Mahomes, it took a lot of the steam out of that game. I mean, we were all fired up for Aaron Rodgers v. Patrick Mahomes. Aaron Rodgers v. Matt Moore does not have the same ring to it, right? The same buzz as Rodgers, Mahomes. But I'll be damned if we didn't get a good game. In fact, Green Bay jumped out early 14-0, and it looked like the blowout was on, except Matt Moore went to work in the second quarter.
Moore takes the snap, fakes the shovel to the middle, throws on the off his back leg for Kelce. He's got it at the six, hops into the end zone, touchdown Chiefs. 29 yards, and Kelce was wide open.
Westwood won. You know, when I see a play like that, I think of a few things. One, my guy, Travis Kelce, stud. Two, you know, credit to Matt Moore. But when I see Matt Moore doing things like that, I immediately think of Andy Reid. Andy Reid was the one that talked Matt Moore out of retirement. Matt Moore was coaching high school football. He was done. Andy Reid is the guy who can coach up any backup into something like that. All of a sudden, Matt Moore looks like a stud. If you didn't think so on that play, how about this one?
And now they run the ball to the left side for Hardman along the sidelines, inside the five, into the end zone. Touchdown, Kansas City. It's a 30-yard run. What a play designed by the Chiefs.
Exactly. What a play designed by the Chiefs. Back to Andy Reid. And then you chase that with a field goal, and the next thing you know, instead of getting blown out, they're up 17-14. And it's not a blowout, it's a shootout. And it kept going right into the second half. The Packers tied up in the third with a field goal, and then Aaron Rodgers did the damn thing. Third and one from the three. Go ahead, roll it.
Now Williams comes out of the backfield. Rodgers drops back to pass, dancing in the pocket. Rolls to the right. He's in trouble. Just tries to get rid of it, and it is caught. Back right corner of the end zone. Touchdown, Packers. Jamal Williams, a diving grab, and the Packers are on top 23-17.
So when you saw that play, how many of you thought that he was throwing it away? How many of you, all of you? I know I did. I've said it before and I'll say it again right now. Every time that guy steps on the field, you know Aaron Rodgers is going to do something that you have never seen before. Even at this juncture of his career, you know the guy's going to do something that you have never seen before, and he did it again right there. Under pressure, falling back, going down. That did not look like a pass. That was a given. He was throwing that ball away to avoid a sack. Except he was throwing it away to the back pylon where only his guy could catch it. And Jamal Williams did. 100 times out of 100, that's an incomplete pass or an interception, except for when Aaron Rodgers throws it, and then it's a TD. Here's his coach, Matt LaFleur, when asked about that pass.
That was one of the best, if not the best, pass I've ever seen live in person. That was incredible. I couldn't believe it. Just a great play because he was under duress, too. I know he ended up on the ground. But credit to Jamal, man, he kept working for him. And it was just one of those plays that kind of leaves you speechless.
Pretty much what that guy does, right? Extend the play, have the intended receiver, Jamal Williams, work for him, find the back of the end zone. And somehow he finds a way where he gets him the ball where only he can catch it. But despite that play, a miracle play, you knew Matt Moore was not going to rest. He led KC right back to tie that game up at 24. And as good as that game would have been if Pat Mahomes was playing, I'm not sure it could have been any better. That's how good that game was. And then the Packers ended it with this.
Rodgers, quick toss to the near side for Jones. Jones has a blocker, steps inside the numbers to the 40. 45, 50, into the open field, Kansas City territory. Sidelines, 25, 20, 15, 10, 5. Touchdown, Green Bay! It's a 67-yard touchdown pass from Rodgers to Jones. And the Packers retake the lead, 30-24.
And if it's a foot race, Aaron Jones is going to win. He made that look easy. That goes down as a 67-yard TD reception. But in reality, that was a forward pass behind the line of scrimmage. And then Jones hit the afterburners and torched KC's defense. So now it's pretty clear who the best team in the AFC is. But when it comes to the NFC, there is a collection of monsters that you can choose from. And you don't want the smoke from any of them, no matter what my dude Bruce says. So who's the team to beat now in the NFC? Packers, Niners, Saints? wide open. It's still the Pats and everybody else in the AFC. But in the NFC, this thing is wide open right now. 1-800-636-8686. The Bears. I mentioned the Falcons were about as disappointing a team as I've seen in recent years at 1-7. The Bears are not far behind because of their expectations too. But they get their own take. It's going to take a little bit of time to set that up for you. When we last spoke, the Astros were down 2-0. Not only down 2-0, but they lost 2 games in a row at home. Not only lost 2 games in a row at home, but lost 2 games at home with their Cy Young Award candidates. And they look like they were DOA. Now I show up here and they're up 3-2. That's coming up. The Queen is in. At Nika 989, Ms. Nika tweets, "I ain't scared of no ghost." Signed, Gardner Flint Minshew II.
I ain't afraid of no ghost.
Jacksonville 29, Jets 15. Look like my man Sam Darnold saw a few more ghosts over the weekend. Boy, he's had a tough, tough year. Lots of bad luck. This is not all on him, but some of it is. And then you've got Gardner Flint Minshew II. What do you do now that Nick Foles is getting closer and closer? Got yourself a little quarterback situation, don't you? Are you going to really take the ball out of his hands, regardless of what you're paying Foles? Jags are back to 4-4. Rome, the names may change, but the Bears are still the same. A quarterback that underwhelms and a kicker that chokes. Jeremiah and Greenville, like I said, they get their own take. Man, Bears fans and Bears honks were so belligerent. Man, just so sure that they had their franchise quarterback. You don't have a kicker. You don't have a quarterback. I'm skeptical that you even have a coach. Dan Wojcicki joins us. Dan, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How are you doing?
So good. Really, really good. Dan, good to have you back. There is so much to talk about in the NBA, but let me start right here. Are you prepared, Dan, for a world where Dwight Howard is now a Laker fan favorite?
I am not. It is like everybody who walked into the arena got like the Men in Black, like sort of like swipey thing in front of their face. You know, the crowd for Dwight Howard, starting really on Friday against Utah when he had 2 points only, but made a bunch of hustle plays. He's wearing this crazy small uniform. Like, I mean, the jersey is like a youth extra large.
Right.
And you know, he's lost all this weight. He doesn't really look like himself. And he's out there doing all these little things and making all these hustle plays. He's never calling for the ball in the post. And, you know, through 3 games really, but the last 2 home games, I mean, it has been sort of like the Dwight Howard he's been like third in line behind LeBron and Anthony Davis in terms of fan support. It's been pretty crazy. We'll see how long it can last. There's some skepticism out there, but so far so good, at least on that gamble.
Dan Wojcicki joining us. Now, before we get into what he did last night and whether or not he could sustain something like this, you were ahead of the curve. You were noticing how much he meant to the Lakers after the Utah game when he didn't even score until the final minutes. What did you see in that game that made you think that he might be able to help this team out?
I mean, he just gave them a physicality, you know, and kept some loose balls alive, and it just was productive. You know, and did it in such small doses that it made sense. I think, to me, the big challenge for guys like Dwight Howard, right, like all NBA players who, for whatever reason, whether it's injuries or age, you know, for guys like Carmelo Anthony, like this has proven to be hard to, like, move into these little complementary roles and figure out ways to kind of be a star in your role, to steal a coaching term. It's not been easy for a lot of guys. Most guys fail at it. And I think to see Dwight kind of humble himself and play this way and to play kind of, you know, the types of minutes that you would normally, you know, like they're like Brian Cardinal minutes, you know what I mean, where you're diving for loose balls and you're challenging shots and you're outworking other people for rebounds. You know, to see that, I think, on Friday against the Jazz, like it made a huge difference in that game. You know, what he did last night against Charlotte was showier. It was more tangible. Obviously, he had points, he had rebounds, he had blocks. The Hornets have a pretty bad interior kind of offense and defense, so the fact that he had a game like that wasn't stunning against them. But I think, you know, he's really stayed in his lane. He hasn't tried to do too much. He's made a couple knuckleheaded decisions, but they're pretty minor compared to the positive things he's done.
Dan Wojcicki joining us. You know, you mentioned Carmelo Anthony. I had Steven Jackson on our podcast last week, and he's firmly convinced that Carmelo has been blackballed from the NBA, and he'll use that phrase if you ask him. Mm-hmm. Is there anything to that, do you think? Why do you think that Carmelo is not playing? Because of an inability to accept a role or something else?
Well, I think that's exactly it. I think the thing that he does best, you know, score the basketball, is the thing that's valued least in the NBA right now, right? Like, there are a lot of good scorers that don't have jobs. You know, Carmelo doesn't have a job. Jamal Crawford doesn't have a job. I mean, that's a guy who scored 50 points in his last NBA game, you know, who's not working right now. I think that the league and the style of play in the NBA is you don't need isolation scorers so much as you do just spot-up shooters, you know. And I mentioned Charlotte. I mean, that's a team that's going to be in a lot of games just because they're going to chuck a bunch of threes. And, you know, who knows who gets hot. And if somebody gets hot and starts making shots, then – you know, they'll be in games. I think it's just easier to find those guys than it is someone like Carmelo Anthony, who's so used to, like, you know, being a focal point. And I think it's hard. You spend your entire career in the spotlight, being the center of an offense, being the most important player on your team, and or at least certainly one of the top two or three, to go into a situation where you're ninth. I think it disrupts rhythm. We've seen way more players fail at it than succeed. I don't think it's a blackballing. I think it's just kind of the league looking around and saying, why try something that we know probably isn't going
to
work?
We're talking to Dan Wojcicki. All right, so the Lakers, Dan, were manhandled by the Clippers on opening night. They had a really nice win over Utah. Then you got last night's win over Charlotte. What do you think about what you've seen from them so far, and how do you like the fit of LeBron and Anthony Davis on the floor together?
I think that's the most interesting, Jim. I mean, I think 2-1 seems about right for where they should be. You know, I think the Clippers are probably the best team in the NBA right now, and they've got Paul George waiting for them. But I think the thing that's been most interesting to watch with the Lakers is kind of how much LeBron has deferred to Anthony Davis. You know, he said that in the summer. He said that, you know, they wanted to play through Anthony Davis. And I think people in the media, myself included, said, sure, you know, you would say that. That makes total sense. I mean, but, you know, this is LeBron freaking James. Like, you know, he's going to get his. And through three games, you know, two of those three games, he has very much been the point guard distributor. I mean, he only scored, I think, 4 points in the first half yesterday. Those points came very late in the half. You know, we were kind of poking around trying to figure out the last time he went scoreless in a half. I believe it had only happened twice in his career. And it, you know, they were doing it because, you know, you load up on LeBron a little bit and you just kind of let Anthony Davis go. You know, I think to me, that's been the biggest thing, is how much he's used AD to take on this bigger role on offense. And I think it's in part, you know, certainly, I mean, part of it, I think, is it makes sense, right? Like, Anthony Davis is a really good player. He gets points around the basket. He's pretty efficient. You know, what's the point of having Anthony Davis if you don't feature him? And I think the secondary point of this, Jim, is that, you know, is LeBron has always been a guy who's taken the long view to seasons. And, you know, the fact that he doesn't have to carry this massive offensive load every night, I think is probably good for him physically. It's probably good for him mentally. And for a team that wants to go deep in the playoffs, I think keeping him as fresh as possible that way, it can only help.
See, I see that exactly like that, and you know he does too. Dan Wojcicki is joining us. Go back to your point about the Clippers being right now the best team in the NBA. Before you were an LA Times national NBA writer, you were a Clippers beat writer. So how far has this organization come in the time since you first started to cover them?
Well, I mean, I think the Clippers had some great players, right? They had Chris Paul, they had Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan was an All-NBA player. When you see Kawhi Leonard in a Clippers uniform, it's just different level. He looks like an all-time great player right now. The way that he kind of can command the ball on offense, the way that he's unstoppable. I mean, he's so big and so strong, and his mid-range game is so good. Poor guys like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope try to guard him. You see the Warriors try to guard him. Phoenix did a decent job. They just double-teamed him every time he had the ball. He's just a different level of player, and then you add that guy who has seemingly the right attitude and the right sort of demeanor for what the Clippers had built last year, as sort of this, you know, for lack of a better term, just like a pain in the ass team, right, that would just like bulldog people up and down the court. You add these things together and you get this fit. And then you look over on the sidelines and you just say, you see this other 6'8", all NBA defensive team, all NBA player, and Paul George just waiting to get out there. And it's scary. You know, that's when you talk to scouts and executives about the Clippers, that's the word that comes up most, is scary. This team hasn't been at its best yet. It's only played 3 games, obviously. Hiccup in Phoenix against a team and the Suns that deserve a lot of credit for how they've come out of the gates this season. But you know, the Clippers have just been, to me, they just look like the real deal when it comes to a contender, a different level than everybody else in the West. We'll see how that plays out over the course of the season with things like load management and injuries and stuff like that. But they've got the goods, and I think everyone around the league kind of knows that already.
We're talking to Dan Wojcicki for a few more moments. You mentioned Golden State. Now, everybody expected Golden State would take a step back this year.
Yeah.
Without Kevin Durant, Andre Iguodala, Sean Livingston moved on, Klay Thompson's out. We knew they'd take a step back, but did you expect this?
No. They're bad right now. And that's maybe underselling how it is. Defensively, they're a total mess. You can guard them in ways that you haven't been able to guard them in the last six seasons. You know, you can blitz Stephen Curry. You're not that worried about what Draymond Green can give you on offense. And while D'Angelo Russell can flash and do some things, he's not Klay Thompson. Doesn't draw the same sort of attention that Klay did. You know, they're going to need some of their young players to take real big steps real quickly to keep them in the playoff hunt. You know, and that's a crazy thing to say about that team, you know, up 2 games into the season. But I think everybody kind of realizes that, you know, in the West, they don't have right now the talent to keep up. You look at their depth. You look at the guys they're playing. They're one of the youngest teams in the league. Steph Curry's their oldest player, Jim, you know, which is kind of a wild thing to think about. But he's going to be great, and he's going to have nights where he carries them to wins. But he can't guard everybody. Draymond Green can't guard everybody. Good teams are just going to shoot layups against him and feast, you know. And I think they're in for a long year. Steve Kerr said it, you know, the last 5 years we've been in fantasy land. You know, the NBA isn't that easy. You know, for most teams it's like this. And they're gonna find that out, I think, more often than not. Getting blown out like they did against the Clippers, getting blown out like they did in their second game, I believe against the Thunder. Like, these are things that are going to happen to them this year. It's going to be a long season.
Got about a minute. Dan, let me ask you this. We've talked in the past about your ongoing series. We've talked to players about their best game ever. Mm-hmm. The latest addition is with Draymond Green. He's had a lot of amazing games. What did he pick as his best game?
He picked a game his senior year of college against Gonzaga, which I think is kind of funny. It speaks to, and it was a game I think he scored 30-plus points. It speaks to, I think, you know, you always hear, like, rappers want to be athletes, athletes want to be rappers. You always want to do what you're not. And here's this guy, this all-around player, this defensive wizard, picking the game where he scored the most points and was couldn't be guarded. You know, I think guys always kind of gravitate towards their college games. Like, those games always mean more, college and high school games. There's more sort of personal sort of pride at stake. It's not as professional, obviously. But I think it's funny to hear a guy like Draymond Green, who I don't think of as a scorer. I expected, you know, a playoff triple-double or something like that, or maybe a game where he locked down LeBron James to be his answer. And to hear him talk about a game where Gonzaga tried, you know, every defender on the team against him and none of it worked. It's kind of funny to hear, like, you could hear sort of in another life, you know, he'd be a guy who would like to go out there and shoot a bunch of shots, score a bunch of points. I mean, I bet right now the Warriors would love to have that player. I don't think he exists anymore in 2019, but it's always a fun series. I really like kind of talking to guys about that.
It is fun. It's a great series. I was going to say in another life, or maybe in this life, they'd love to see that too. He's a national NBA writer for the LA Times. Good friend of the program, Dan Wojcicki, my guest. Dan, thanks so much. Great to have you back.
All right, Jim. Talk to you soon.
I'm probably like a lot of you, and I think that many of us have the same question, namely, where does our family come from? What's our background? You can discover more about your family and learn about your own story by combining the Ancestry DNA test with billions of historical family records. This is so detailed and so fascinating. Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. You see, Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started, and they're able to do so by using precise geographic detail and clear-cut historical insights. It's amazing what they uncover. You can even trace your ancestors' journeys over time. You can follow how and why your family moved from place to place, things that you don't even know. And to amplify your results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree. So your ancestors become more than just a name. They've combined DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. Only Ancestry can lay out a story like this and tell a story like this with unique features that give a more complete picture about a person, like the events that shaped that person, how they made a living, and what they excelled in. What I'm saying is, Ancestry's unique features and record collections can give a more complete picture of people from your past, like the events that shaped them, how they made a living, even how long they attended school, and it's so easy to get started. Just go to Ancestry.com/Rome right now and get 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. That's Ancestry.com/Rome and take 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/Rome. This is a fascinating process. Check it out yourself. The old cliche is what a difference a weekend makes. But in the case of this World Series, what a difference a weekend makes. When this show ended on Friday, the Astros were down 0-2 to the Nats. Their aces had just been beaten at home. They had been smoked and melted down in game two, and they were headed back to the district where everybody was feeling great and you knew it was going to be a madhouse. So Houston didn't just have their backs up against the wall. They had their backs up against the wall with the Nationals-shaped buzzsaw spinning in on them. Washington had won 8 straight postseason games. They were doing whatever the hell they wanted, whenever the hell they wanted. But then Houston, heart of the champion, they go to work. 4-1 win on Friday. 8-1 win on Saturday, including a legendary showing from Jose Urquidy and a grand slam from my man Alex Bregman. Now it's a series again. Now we're headed into a best of three. Game 5 battle between Gerrit Cole and Max Scherzer. Rerun of Game 1. The thing we were all looking forward to. I mean, one of the best matchups ever. Gerrit Cole and Max Scherzer. Except it wasn't. A few hours before that game, Scherzer was scratched with an irritated nerve in his neck. And let me stop right there. Because I know you better than you know you. I know what you're going to say before you say it. I know what you're going to thumb out on Twitter, especially before you thumb that out. If any of you losers want to take a run at Scherzer for not pitching yesterday, if that thought even crossed your mind for a split second, you better apologize right now. Now, you know Max Scherzer. This is not a little issue. You know this guy's got to be absolutely jacked up physically if he's not out there. And raging emotionally that he's not out there for his teammates.
I'm as disappointed as I possibly can be to be on that pitch tonight. I mean, that's game 5 of the World Series. I've pitched through so much crap in my career that, I mean, that would be easy to pitch through at this point. This is literally impossible to do anything with.
He's like, I have pitched through so much crap in my career. It's like, we're all just a bunch of babies. I don't want to get touched. Don't touch me. I don't want to get touched. I'm going to get my 60 goals. I want my 60 goals. How am I going to get my 60 goals? They're touching me. We got a few whining babies out there. Scherzer. How do we do that again? Scherzer went old school Larry Robinson for us.
I'm as disappointed as I possibly can be to be on that pitch tonight. I mean, that's game 5 of the World Series. I've pitched through so much crap in my career that, I mean, that would be easy to pitch through at this point. This is literally impossible to do anything with.
All right, so I'm not doing that just to play that soundbite. It's accurate. He's pitched through so many different things in his career. A 3-time Cy Young Award winner. So before any of you dopes say anything about how, yeah, if I woke up with a stiff neck, I'd still go to work. Oh, so I slept on the wrong side of the bed. I'd be out there, and that would just be Wednesday. How the hell is that guy not out there for Game 5 of the World Series? If any of you dopes were thinking about coming up in here to say that, understand that's not what happened.
I woke up this morning completely locked up. I couldn't do anything. I mean, couldn't even dress myself. So I had to have my wife help me. So that's where I was at.
The guy literally couldn't even help himself, couldn't even dress himself. So if the guy could take the baseball, he would. This is a guy who's looking to compete in anything all the time. And you're going to tell me that he can't go in Game 5 of the World Series at home to give his team a 3-2 lead, that he wouldn't go if he could. Now, what that tells me is this guy's in complete and total agony. Not to mention, he did take the spike. He did. The difference is, apparently, if you take that cortisone shot that he took, doctors say it takes about 48 hours to kick in. So he did take the spike. And if they can get it somehow to Game 7, he might still be able to take the ball. Point being, the guy is doing everything in his power to be out there with his teammates. He is trying to rejoin the fight. No one needs to tell Scherzer how important this is. He simply cannot go. So Washington does what they have to do. They give the ball to Joe Ross in the first inning. Yordan Alvarez took that same ball from Ross, and he hit it about 1,000 feet in the second inning.
Here's a 2-1. And Alvarez lifts it pretty deep to center field. Robles is racing back, still going back, looking up. See you later! A 2-run home run for Yordan Alvarez.
Pretty deep. Yeah, pretty deep, or to the deepest part of the ballpark. He hit it about 1,000 feet. Astros radio on the call. 2-0 Astros. And then Carlos Correa did something very similar in the fourth.
Alvarez now the lead at second. Ross takes a look back at him. He brings it in. Swinging a long drive to left. Forget about it. This is way, way back and gone. A hanging cutter hit for a 2-run homer, and Carlos Correa makes it 4-0 Houston.
Nats radio knew where that ball was going to end up. Yeah, but you know what, though? Don't focus on that rocket. Did you see the pitch that he took down 0-2? Now, that was brass. Almost as brass as the Astros coming into the district, down 2-0, and leaving up 3-2, while allowing just 3 runs in 3 games in Washington. Houston had so many guys step up last night. Alvarez, Correa, Cole went 7, struck out 9, allowed just that 1 run. But I have to say, the real star last night had to be Lance Barksdale. And if you did not know the legendary name of Lance Barksdale before last night, you do now, because OLB was the genius working behind the plate. And he might have done more than anything to usher in the era of robot umps. Yeah, I said it. Robot umps. Hey, listen, there are few things worse than complaining about balls and strikes. Generally, I'm not here for that. But last night, just about every single complaint was justified. And yet another problem for the game of baseball. Now, let me say this right now. The Nationals have got nobody to blame for last night's loss and for losing 3 straight at home after taking a 2-0 series lead but themselves. Ryan Zimmerman said it, quote, "Lance didn't lose us the game tonight. Gerrit Cole beat us," end quote. That's true. Except that does not mean that Lance did a great job last night, because Lance did not do a great job last night. And I'm not just talking about whatever the hell Lance was seeing and calling in the bottom of the seventh when he called ball 4 on a pitch from Cole to Zimmerman that Cole thought was a strike. Or I'm not just talking about when he called strike 3 to Victor Robles on a pitch that was higher and further outside than the pitch to Zimmerman.
Zim runs the 3-2. Strike 3 called, and Robles was ready to head down to first, and now the Nationals dugout is steaming. Lance Barksdale is looking at Davey Martinez, again is frustrated with the home plate umpire as he rings up Robles on a high strike, and Robles has fired the elbow guard in the direction of the home plate umpire. He's got to be careful.
He threw his helmet and his gloves and the elbow guard, and Lance Barksdale pointed at him, so that might be a fine.
Well, pitch track had it off the outside corner just a hair.
Terrible.
Yeah, way outside. So what was that? Was that a makeup call? I don't know what that was. I have no idea what that was, but I know it made a difference. A walk there, and A.J. Hinch probably comes to get Cole, and then who knows what happens. In that case, Houston is going to their bullpen with a tying run at the plate, and anything can happen. Instead, the inning is over. The game was pretty much over. Houston adds another in the eighth, two more in the ninth, and then your final is 7-1. Now, like I said, I'm not just talking about that call. I'm talking about the one in the sixth. Nationals reliever Tanner Rainey is on the mound, pitching to Michael Brantley. Here's his 2-2 offering.
They caught the strike zone.
I mean, it looked like a strike. Nationals catcher Yan Gomes sure thought it was a strike because he hopped up to throw it around the horn. You know, maybe he was selling it or maybe he knew it was a strike. But apparently, he jumped up too quickly and did not hold it in the strike zone long enough for Barksdale to call it a strike. So how long does he need to hold it before Lance thinks that's a strike? And isn't it a strike when it crosses the plate? Or does Barksdale need to say it's a strike before it's a strike? Or does he need a few minutes to decide whether or not it's a strike? I don't know, but either Barksdale knew it was a strike, but didn't like Gomes getting up to call it a strike, and he called it a ball, or maybe he really thought that was not a strike. Either way, it's not a good look, and something that had the entire world wishing for cyborg umps. Listen to the sound on this. It's amazing. You can hear Gomes say to Barksdale, "Oh, it's my fault." You know, like he got up too quickly. The only thing missing was the ump saying, "Let me tell you something. It's a strike when I call it a strike and not a second before. It's not a strike when it crosses the zone. It's not a strike until I say it's a strike." Davey Martinez has seen about enough. You can hear him yell all the way from the dugout, "It's the World Series. Wake up.
It's the World Series.
Go.
Wake up."
See, that's the thing. You might think it's the World Series, but it kind of felt like the Lance Barksdale show. And if you think you're going to jack with the Lance Barksdale show by getting out of your crouch too early or by asking him to be consistent, or to remind him that it's the World Series, or to show him up in any way whatsoever, you got another thing coming. Because Lance Barksdale does whatever the hell Lance Barksdale wants to do. And because of Lance Barksdale, we're now talking more about robot umpires than we've ever talked about. And I never thought that I would say it, but I'm actually open to it. In fact, I'm starting to want it, because I would rather watch the World Series than the Lance Barksdale show. If this is the only way we can get the World Series back is by giving it to the robots, then I want the World Series back.
It's the World Series!
Go!
Wake up!
I've pitched through so much crap.
Y'all just a bunch of... Y'all just a bunch of...
So much crap.
Babies. I want my 60 goals. Speaking of which...
so much crap.
Larry Robinson, one of the greatest defensemen ever.
I can't get my 60 goals.
Alexander Mattison is my guest. Alexander, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to visit with you. Thanks so much. You know, you're coming off a fourth straight win and another game where you were very productive. Because you played on Thursday night, you do get a little extra time to get ready for the next game. How valuable is that to get that extra time at the halfway point of the season?
Oh, man, it's pretty... Me being, you know, in my first year, I'm not really, used to how things are going, but it's something that I definitely can see is a big impact, and it's definitely something that is needed.
You know, you mentioned this being your first year. Let me skip ahead of that. I had Kevin King from the Packers on the show last week, and he talked about how that transition from college to the NFL is much tougher than people think because the quality of play is so much better. But he also mentioned you have so much more free time. And as he points out, it's easy to get lost in the sauce. So let me ask you, what was the transition from college to the NFL been like for you so far? Has it been what you expected? What's it been like?
It's definitely been... It hasn't been, for me, as hard as I thought it would be, necessarily overall, because I'm pretty used to making sure that I'm taking care of my body and, I don't do much outside of football besides, you know, hang out at the house and my mom's out here with me, so I spend time with her. And so it'd be harder for me to get lost in the sauce, as you would say, but I definitely think that probably the biggest transition would be going from, you know, a pretty detailed playbook in college to a more vast one that's like, you know, three times of what you would think of in college, because there's so many different variations of certain plays and things like that. And then it comes down to trying to learn all that and process that, and at the same time picking up blitzes and making your right reads and doing all that just at a faster speed with more intensity because, you know, the guys on the other side, they've all been all pros. They've all been, you know, all Americans at some point. So, yeah, that's definitely one of the bigger transitions.
Alexander Mattison joining us. All right, so you mentioned your mom. Let me ask you about Pearl. Pearl came to training camp and was with you, making sure that you were taken care of in terms of food and everything else. How special was it to have her there?
I mean, it's amazing. She, you know, she does an amazing job of just making sure that I'm okay. And so I just try and do the same and to make sure she's okay. And, you know, I love my mom, and having her around is awesome because I get some home-cooked meals that I haven't tasted in a long time, especially being away in college. So it's nice to have her around and get to spend some more time with her.
Can I tell you something else about this that I'm so impressed with? It wasn't like she was just hanging out with you or even just making your meals. She got a job while she was in town. What's it say about your mom that she didn't want to just relax, but she got a gig at Walmart and she went to work while you were at camp?
Yeah. She's, that's the type of person she is. She doesn't want to just sit around and not really do anything. She likes to put her energy into something, and she's a passionate person. So, her being the people person that she is, she likes to meet new people and get to know the area, get to know the community. So that's what she's doing, and she's having fun while she's doing it.
Vikings running back Alexander Mattison is joining us. So you and Dalvin Cook really seem to feed off each other really well. How would you describe the relationship that the two of you have, and then how much does each of you help the other on the field?
Oh, man. I mean, if you ever see us around, we're always joking around with each other. It's a big brother, little brother relationship we got, and I think that it's definitely something special when we can make sure that we're both clicking on the field and doing the right thing. And so he motivates me to do better, and he tells me that I motivate him too, which is weird for me to hear, but it's awesome. It's awesome.
That's really high praise coming from him. Alexander Mattison joining us. You said that you guys were clicking together. You know, if you go back a few weeks, there was a lot of talk about the offense and how things were not clicking. Since that time, though, you guys have won four straight. You're right back in the thick of it. What do you think has been the biggest key for the last 4 weeks for the offense, and how did it come together the way it has?
I think it's us putting everything to the side and really just not getting in our heads too much, not listening to outside noise, and knowing that we're capable of, what we want to accomplish. And so we've just been working at our craft and trying to make sure that we're cleaning things up and playing, you know, Vikings football. And so there's a lot of things that we did right, but there's a lot of things that we did wrong in those wins that we've had. So we're just trying to go through and make sure that we clean up those things and try and make sure that in these last eight games that we're an even better team than we were in the first eight.
Now, in terms of approach, you've made no secret of the fact that you like the grit of the game. You like doing the dirty work. You like picking up 2- and 3-yard runs. What is it about those runs that you have to grind out that you like so much? And then where does the attitude come from?
Definitely, there's some satisfaction and some prideful joy you get out of, running through arm tackles and picking up yards that, might not necessarily have been able to get from the looks of it, and then you come out and you get more yards than you expected. And so I just really enjoy the competitive aspect of the grind, and I'm going to beat you, and I want to beat the man across from me. And I think that has something to do, where I came from, the way I was raised, and playing this game for a long time. It's just, I'm pretty competitive, and I just love to make sure that I can impose my will on someone else.
In terms of where you came from San Bernardino here in Southern California. And when you were growing up, things were not always easy. There were stretches where the family had to struggle to make ends meet. And then when you were 13, your father was diagnosed with leukemia. I've been through this. My father had leukemia. Anybody who's been through this knows what that can be like. In fact, what was that like for you and your family, especially when you were so young?
It was one of those times where you know, you have, you know, all you can do is leave it up to God and pray. And, you know, I came to the point where I knew where there's nothing I could do besides pray and just hope that things get better. And at first it kind of took a real toll on me, especially at that age and making that transition into high school and stuff like that. And football was one of those things that really kept me from really falling off the deep end with that. And my parents, you know, they were really, really good on emphasizing how important grades were, how important a lot of different things were, how important family is to us. And so during that time, we just stayed strong as a family. We stayed strong as a family. They made sure that we know there's nothing that we can do personally. So make sure that we take care of what we need to take care of to make him proud. And, you know, that'll give him the strength to pull through.
Alexander Mattison joining me for a few more moments. He is a rookie. You know, it's not just football. I mean, football may have helped in keeping you grounded, but through the entire thing, your parents continued to stress academics. Legend has it that you enrolled in a dual immersion language program. You're fluent in Spanish. You were a wrestling champ, a 110-meter hurdles champ, and you graduated with a ridiculously high GPA. How were you able to manage all of that and accomplish all that with all that that was going on?
Oh, man, I couldn't even tell you. I think it's just the passion in me. Like I said, I'm a competitor, and I understand that, especially me being a young African-American male in today's society, that I needed to make sure I set myself apart. And my mom, she enrolled me in the dual immersion program when I was younger. And I'm grateful that she did that. At first, I didn't want to do it, but I understand, especially growing up in Southern California, how important it was to kind of be able to, you know, have that diversity. And, you know, there's a lot of situations where I use it, you know, even in the store, helping my mom with certain things. And so that's something I'm grateful for. But at the same time, when I look at balancing academics, balancing football, track and field, wrestling, balancing all of that, I mean, it all came down to just the way my parents raised us, and that was just to, you know, be fighters, and that's something that we've always been used to doing. And so I never really let it overwhelm me. It was in my spirit. You know, I'm a competitive person, and I just loved everything that I was doing, and I just knew that I had to try and set myself apart in order to be successful.
It's so good, and it's so true, but still, it's so challenging. Let me ask you this finally. When you're coming up in San Bernardino, there is no guarantee that you're going to play Division I football. You might have had the dream, you might have had the ambition, but there are no guarantees. What was it about Boise State, of all places, that made you feel like that was the right place?
I definitely would say the environment, the coaching staff, the vibe that I got from them was just, it felt like I was going to go be a part of a family rather than just a football program. And, you know, coming from where I come from, San Bernardino, not too many people make it out. So I wanted to make sure I made the right decision. And I didn't end up back there. I didn't end up, you know, there's certain people that have had the opportunity but didn't, you know, go all the way or things like that. So I really trusted in Coach Marks and Coach Harson. And you know, it was probably the perfect fit for me as far as the environment, the school, and then the football program. And so I just prayed about it a lot, and that's where my heart was leading me. And so I'm super grateful. And Boise State is – that's one of the better decisions of my life, to attend Boise State University. And so, yeah, I'm super grateful for them even giving me the opportunity to be a part of that.
And you were 10th all-time at that school in rushing, an all-conference player, and having a really productive rookie year with the Vikings, 331 rushing yards, 13 carries, a couple of receptions in the win over Washington. Just 21 years of age, and Minnesota is at Kansas City on Sunday. Alexander Mattison, my guest. Alexander, couldn't be more impressed. Great to have you on the show. Thanks very much. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you. I really appreciate you.
Good night now!